Welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast, a podcast incorporating narratives about facing and navigating adversity, a mixture of people, their experiences, and professional psychological discussion. I'm Dr. Tara Quinn-Tirillo. I'm a qualified and regulated psychologist with over 20 years' experience of mental health, disability, and human behaviour. I want to share people's stories of navigating adversity in the hope that through being heard, a dose of compassion and some understanding, we can help others in the face of adversity too.
Hi, and welcome to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I am Dr. Tara Quinn-Tirillo, and today I have an incredible guest with me, Susie Redding. Would you like to say hello and tell us a little bit about who you are and what's brought you on today?
I would. Oh, Tara, thank you for such a lovely, warm welcome. So I'm Susie Redding. I'm a chartered psychologist. I'm the author of 10 different titles on various ways that we can take care of ourselves. And the last one, How to Be Selfish, yes. Which is, it's a little bit of a departure from that because I'm done with asking women to take care of themselves. I want women to be cared for.
Yes.
So this latest book is all about self-honoring, self-advocacy, and how we can feel safe and confident to speak up on our behalf.
Yes.
And I also want to be totally transparent with you. Qualifications aside, I think it's very much my life experience that has shaped my work as a psychologist. For the last decade, I would have said that, yep, my skill set lended itself beautifully to empowering people with the tools of self-care, and that very much came about from my own lived experience of becoming a mum at the same time as losing my dad to motor neurone disease.
Right.
I think in hindsight, and probably with the fire of perimenopause fueling me, I've re-understood that lesson from it wasn't just about self-care. It was learning to advocate for self. But I think that's certainly become much more prevalent in the last decade. So lived experience informs us all, doesn't it, Tara?
Oh, do you know, I think it makes us humans, especially as psychologists. So we're similar age. When I qualified, it was very much taboo, actually, to kind of be a human behind the psychologist, and it's really started to shift. And I think that's what people resonate with, the fact that we are humans, we have feelings, we have lives, and to show that vulnerability, I think, could be really empowering for people, can't it?
I think it's absolutely essential in this age of automation and AI. We need the human element. And from what I'm learning, like, I think the more that we can embrace our messy humanity, that's almost like the secret sauce to just about everything in terms of coping with life.
Absolutely. So what I wanted to talk about today, so this is something in terms of where I'm at in my life stage, it's kind of, I'm going to use the word midlife. So midwife women, particularly midlife, and just facing everything that's happening in our mind and our bodies. For those of us that may be parents, we're in the middle of GCSEs. We've been talking about that off camera with our eldest. We may have parents who are aging and have different needs. Sometimes that self can get lost. And what I really love about your work is talking about the kind of guilt and the shame behind that. That's what I want to deconstruct today. And how then we can start to advocate, you know, drop the guilt of looking after ourselves. Because for many, I know, actually, I just had a coffee this morning with a mum friend. You can feel guilty for even wanting to, even if you've recognised it. And that's why I thought, right, you're the perfect person to have on. Where should we start? Why is it, particularly at kind of midlife, do you think that we just get so much more overwhelmed maybe other times of life and might lose that sense of self and kind of purpose a bit?
Okay. I think it's, I mean, there are so many cultural threads to it.
Yeah.
I think it's to do with the kind of messaging that we've been marinating in since birth that's encouraged us to think that our worth is contingent upon how much self-sacrifice we can do, you know, how little we need others, how well we facilitate everybody else. I think in midlife, it's, if I look at what I was able to muscle my way through in my 20s and 30s and some of my 40s, I just don't have that capacity right now.
Yes.
And I think also the demands on us are just immense, whether you're parenting young children or children that are preparing to leave the nest, or you're caring for elderly parents, we're still running businesses, or we're still, you know, in employed roles, we're still tending to our own relationships, siblings.
Absolutely.
It's it's such a squeeze. It's such a squeeze. And I think this is where we sort of realize that we can't be all things to all people. And there is this, there's this reckoning, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I was kind of thinking, is there something about, you know, if I look back now, I'm very close with my own mother. Was it different then to now? And I do think we're in much faster paced society, the kind of digital. I will say as well, so I had a full time working mum. She was a midwife, a health visitor, did everything. But she was kind of saying that there's less digital stuff then. So she could come home and decompress in a different way. You know, there weren't school apps. They weren't kind of running your business online. And I do think that kind of society and social media perpetuating, doing all the things, but doing them perfectly as well. And I know I struggle from getting hooked with that. I don't know whether, have you noticed that in the people that you work with, in the businesses that you work with?
Oh, definitely. I notice it too. You know, and I'm well aware of this, you know, the comparison trap, and yet I will still see what my colleagues are doing. I think the fact is we have this window into the lives of others.
Yeah.
Like growing up, you used to have, we had this TV, films, there was the radio, there was newspapers. But there was also beautiful silence post 9 p.m. No one would call you, you know, unless it was an absolute emergency. And now we've got these things that beep at us all day long. Yes. And we have a window into the lives of other people, people we don't even know. Yes. And there's so much information. It is completely overwhelming. We've got to very carefully manage our relationship with these things. And I really do think that one big reset overnight is not enough for us to cope with the vast, the stimulation, the volume of choices, the communication that everyday life entails now. It's very, very different to what our parents were navigating.
Do you think there might be a bit of a myth then in terms of, well, I'll just have a good sleep and we'll start again tomorrow, rather than kind of looking at how this stuff builds up, actually, that overwhelm? You know, there's a lot of social media at the moment about burnout and people are getting more and more educated. But I'm wondering whether there's still a bit of a misconception that a good night's sleep will resolve things and that we start fresh the next day.
You know, let's not discount how important sleep is.
Yeah.
and I would quite often suggest one of the starting points when I'm working with clients is if they're in a period of squeeze and it's like, well, do you need another coping tool, or actually do you need to prioritize sleep? Do you need some help getting to sleep? But I'd also say you're absolutely spot on. Good sleep alone is not going to be enough to help us navigate the plethora of ways in which we're being depleted and how we're being called upon.
Yes.
It's not enough these days. We need opportunities to rest and restore throughout the day. And we do need to have a look at our relationship with our thoughts and our feelings and each other and our relationship with self. Sleep's not going to sort that.
When I first got connected with you, so I followed you on Instagram, and you have some absolutely fantastic posts that you share that are, I'm going to say, wonderfully simple in terms of sometimes it's just a sentence or two that hits hard. And I remember sitting in my old house in the garden. I was in the middle of a divorce. I was running several branches of my business and just going, gosh, how can I do the parenting, the separating and all other things? And there was just one little post that you did, which was about giving yourself permission to pause. And I remembered reading it and going, that's so wonderfully simple, but crikey, I've never thought of it that way, that you kind of get caught up in the, I'll be okay if I have an action plan for all of these things and I just keep going, rather than pausing. And I've got a lot better at doing that because of following your work. And I think that's one of the reasons that people need to follow you, because I think we overthink how we deal with our emotional and our physical health, that it has to be about doing things, you know, apps and strategies and rotors. But actually, it's taking that step back sometimes and going, do you know what? No. Because that's sometimes when you get a bit more clarity at what you want in the longer term. And I don't know if you've had that from other people in terms of the simplifying emotional health and what we need.
That just makes my heart sing. You know, often we share these things on social media.
Yeah.
And you sort of, I mean, I know the impact that these insights and these, you know, promises to self have had in my life, and I see it working in the lives of my clients.
Yes.
Sort of, you wonder how they land. So, oh, gosh, that is just my ears. And I think that, this is something that I come up a lot with in my therapeutic work. I think what people say to themselves is, I've got to think my way out of this. I've just got to try harder. I'm not resilient enough. And it's actually, you don't need to push more. Yeah. What you actually need is a little more softness. Maybe you need to go slower. Maybe you need to go gentler.
Yes.
This is the key. You know, this is the stuff that will allow us to shift the state of our nervous system so that we can access parts of ourselves that can be more coaxing and encouraging rather than, you know, they're so hard to access when we're in the midst of the stress response.
Absolutely. And what I think is really lovely now is more and more people are doing what, you know, we used to call old term kind of psychoeducation. People don't grow up, they're not educated at school to know what the fight or flight system is and how to spot signs of overwhelm. And therefore, we can get in those what I call, you know, behavioral loops, where it's just keep doing more things, more strategies. And you're absolutely right. It's that thinking my way out of it. But that all takes it. People don't realize you can get fatigue from thinking and working things through, do they? Yeah.
You've got to be resourced for that. You know,
absolutely.
I've been having some interesting conversations. This week is Mental Health Awareness Week.
Yes.
And a lot of people are saying to me, like, the thing that I hear often in my consulting room is I either want to get rid of this thought or I want to get rid of this feeling. Yeah. And one of the anecdotes that I've been sharing this week is I was on the London Underground this week. I was going down one of those really long escalators and I'm standing on the right, making space for people on the left. And this thought came to me of, what would happen if I accidentally stuck my foot out and I tripped one person over and there'd be like this, like, you know, domino effect of how many people would fall? And instead of saying to myself, what an asshole for having that thought, I was able to step back and go, I didn't choose that thought. That thought is not who I am. I don't want that to happen. That is the antithesis of what I want to happen. And the fact that I find that thought so abhorrent speaks to really what matters to me. Yes. However, the thing is, I wasn't able to just access that healthy relationship with my thinking because I've got the knowledge.
Yes.
I was able to access it because I'd had a decent night's sleep the nights before. I'd had breakfast. I'd hydrated my sense of humor. I was going somewhere that I was excited about, so there was purpose. It's like you have to be resourced to be able to cope with these inner experiences. So, you know, the cognitive tools are just one part of it.
Yes.
We need the energy to action it.
And do you know what? I think that's actually very true for professionals. So the thing that I love now about more kind of mental health and wellbeing professionals that are kind of in the social media space is actually there can be a misconception that you know it all. And I get that a lot as a psychologist, but you must be really great at dealing with this and this. You've got all your stuff together, so to speak. But actually, that's all very cognitive stuff. I may have a head full of techniques like yourself, but you have to be in a position to be able to use them, but also introducing self-compassion when there may be times when we're not able to, or we notice that we didn't respond in a way that might align with who we are and our values. And I think that's so, so important.
Do you know, I think if I had to choose just one skill, it would be self-compassion. Yes. Because the fact is you can do all sorts of other activities. And you can render those activities useless by what you say to yourself while you're doing it. So I think that's just why it's so fundamental. But, you know, it comes back to our relationship with self, doesn't it?
And one of the things that really struck me, so this is an area of interest and has been for a little while, I'd love to write something more on this, is kind of women approaching midlife, dealing with all of the things, whatever that be, and why it is that we may be particularly vulnerable, I think, to guilt, to shame about trying to find out who we are, living with a little bit more purpose related to self, and how we drop that guilt. And maybe even to start with, what is it that makes us feel so guilty at going, where am I now in my life? What do I want? What don't I want? And immediately that guilt monster's there going, nope, that's not okay.
Yeah. I think we've been raised to revere selflessness and to be phobic of being seen as selfish.
Yes. Because it's quite a loaded word, isn't it?
Oh. I mean, is there a more toxic criticism than being labelled as selfish?
Yeah.
No one would, no midlife woman would aspire to being labelled as that.
Yeah.
And how quick are we to label ourselves as selfish, but also how quick society is to label women as selfish. I don't think we label men selfish when they're engaging in similar choices or behaviours that we would label a woman for selfish, as selfish. And I think we've got to also take a look at how we're participating with this archetype, because when I hear people say, I feel selfish, women, let me clarify, women saying I feel selfish, they're doing things like resting.
Yes.
Or taking a moment for themselves after they've spent their entire day tending to the needs of others.
Yes.
When they're saying no, or perhaps when they're leaning on others or thinking about leaning on others for support, reaching out for support. Now, none of these things are necessarily selfish.
Yes.
Okay.
So would
we also, if we were observing another friend behaving in those ways, we would potentially even admire them for these direct, forthright, self-honoring behaviors. We'd be thinking, fantastic, good on them. And yet the moment we turn our attention inwards, it's shame-inducing because of the selfless woman archetype. Yes. So we have to hold it up to the light. We have to see that there is this thing that we've been told, but we no longer need to subscribe to this being our truth. And I think it's just so important that we understand that we can make a meaningful contribution to this world in our own right, not just by virtue of what we've facilitated in the lives of others.
Yes, absolutely. The thing that struck me there, and I'm hoping that will also resonate with listeners and viewers, is it's sometimes just the most simple things we can feel guilty for. So as a mum, sometimes, you know, you might get an offer for let's go away for the day somewhere, let's go away for the weekend, going out for drinks or something like that. That could be a little bit more loaded, but sometimes it's just the everyday stuff. I'm just pausing, I'm taking a moment. Yeah. And, you know, herd instinct, societal norms, when you're seen to be pausing in the midst of other people, I think that ramps up the guilt. But I think it's actually really important for people to know that sometimes that guilt and shame will show up over the simplest things, you know, having an extra 10 minutes in bed while your partner does the school run or something. They're doing that. I'm here. I am lazy. You're more likely to have those kind of loaded cognitions, aren't you? It's not just those big things.
No.
Time away. It took me a long time to see that, that you kind of, because you're so busy doing all the things. Mm. I think there's already a baseline of pausing isn't okay. You know, I should be doing X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
And for people that may be new to that concept of shame, when you kind of work with your clients and the businesses that you work with, the kind of public facing work you do, how do you tend to kind of describe shame? Because I'm always really interested in different ways that people explain that concept, because it's so powerful.
So the way that I've, the understanding that I've come to is to make a distinction between guilt and shame.
Yes.
So I would understand guilt as this thing that I've done, this is not the right thing. That's a bad thing.
Yes.
Yeah. Whereas shame feels like I'm a bad human being. It goes right to the core of who we think we are. And there is so much that we've been taught about this selfless woman archetype that does, it instantly triggers shame. Whether we're prioritizing self, giving an opinion, taking up space, expressing emotions, expressing needs, I would suggest that most of those things have become shame-inducing for a lot of midlife women. And then they don't make us bad human beings. They make us human.
It's quite powerful just to hear that, isn't it? I remember watching the movie Bad Moms when it, you know, years ago now, when that first came out, and just going, oh my goodness, whoever made and directed that just got it. That kind of, I'm wondering whether there's something about our generation where you do have more women who maybe are working and parenting. There's a lot more people working in kind of entrepreneur spaces. So you're doing all the things. It's not a job where you kind of clock in, clock out, and then you're home. So that I think we are holding a lot more, especially if you're working like ours. It doesn't, there's no on and off. It's, you're there all the time with it. And that movie really resonated with me in terms of the shame that other mums give other mums. You know, you haven't done the thing for the bake sale, or you weren't able to come to that assembly that day. The shame we give ourselves, but it does also come externally as well sometimes. Even if people don't realize it, from your own kids. I've had numerous occasions where maybe I haven't been able to make an assembly and co-parent has, or vice versa, but there will always be that you weren't there. And maybe developmentally and understanding that at that age, but also that stuff stays with you, doesn't it? You know, that
it really does.
Like, yeah, sometimes you're like,
that judgment is your work. Real. Yeah.
And I'm wondering how many of us, I mean, watching that movie, the kind of the home bake sale thing really struck me of the times where maybe I haven't had time to make a cake and it's more important to have something to share and people being together for me. So my values would dictate that it's okay not to have made something, but there's still that shame, isn't there? I'm the one with that plastic container in that movie really struck me, but also how refreshing it was to step outside the narrative and go, I would recommend that people watch it just to kind of see how the different layers of shame, especially around parenting.
Absolutely. Can we give ourselves permission to fail at what's humanly possible?
Yes.
And I think we've been missold this idea that we've been told that you can do anything. And really what that means is you should be able to do everything simultaneously. And you can't work like you don't parent, and you can't parent like you don't work. And yet we've been reared to believe that you should be able to do it all. It's humanly impossible. So let's give ourselves permission to fail at what's humanly possible. Just one human being. I wonder how many times would we need to clone ourselves to be able to do everything to the degree that we want to be able to do it. I'm more than a dozen already, I'm sure of it.
And the fact that sometimes that permission to fail can mean that we are sitting within So I do a lot of acceptance and commitment therapy, very values-based, but it's about learning to kind of sit with that uncomfy. And sometimes we might make a decision, go, do you know what, I just can't do that. I'm having to make a decision, putting some good boundaries in. But then along comes the visceral, more cognitive stuff, more emotions, and learning how to sit with that. Because it's sometimes that kind of after stuff that makes you then relent on that boundary the next time, or work extra hard because you're feeling guilty that you didn't do or you said no to something. And I think that's where that circle of shame can really come into its own, can't it?
It does. We need a little circuit breaker, don't we?
Yes.
Yeah. And I think you're absolutely spot on. I use the ACT approach as well. And I love it because it just helps me feel at peace with all of these inner experiences.
Yes.
I know I don't have to run away from it, get rid of it. I can just make space for it. And I think where it comes to guilt, what helps me is acknowledging that the presence of guilt doesn't mean that I've done something wrong or I'm about to do something wrong. It's there as a messenger to prompt me to check in with my moral compass.
Yeah.
All right. So just because it's there doesn't mean I've done something wrong. I can choose for myself. Is this thing contingent with what matters to me as a human being? Bearing in mind that sometimes that question is not always easy to answer.
Yeah. You
know, it's not always this is right or this is wrong. It's like, okay, so for me as an individual, this feels right. For me as a mum, there's this. There's for me as a wife now, there's this. And for me as a daughter, there's this. Do you know what? But I think it's coming back to that lived experience of how workable is our self-denial?
Yes.
At what cost?
Really good question.
Denying our human needs.
Yes.
And I can put my hand up and I can say, I know where it goes because I've lived it. I've made that choice of, no, I'll prioritize the needs of everyone above myself. And where it wound me up was energetic bankruptcy.
Yes.
Did that serve the people that I loved? Nope. Did it serve me? Nope. Am I ever going to allow myself, where it's possible to control it, wind up in that position again? Never. I will always choose this path of gentle self-honoring because I know that that's what my loved ones need. And I, by and large, I don't feel guilty about that, but there's still times that it comes up, but I let it go along for the ride. I don't let it stop me. It can come with. Come on.
Absolutely. Like sometimes, again, you've mentioned two things there, that there can be a bit of a tendency in society kind of perpetuates this. We need to get rid of intolerable stuff, whether that's tricky thoughts, emotions, kind of visceral body symptoms. It's the making room for it. So it's not what we're not saying today is that actually we need to not have any guilt. It is going to show up. It's part of life, but it's our relationship with it when it shows up.
Yeah. And can you imagine how messy the world would be without guilt? We don't want that. Yeah. What we don't want is for guilt to derail us.
Yes.
Yeah. Take the nourishing action anyway, and the feeling of guilt will diminish. We can survive it.
Kind of the dropping the stress, the pressure, the energy it takes to get rid of unwanted emotions. What I love there is you use a lot that word nourishing. And that's one of the things I really love about your work. There's a lot of, I love the fact you use the word kind of darling and honey, and it's really positive self-talk, isn't it, in your social media posts. But that kind of nourishing that some people might go, well, I'm really noticing having listened to this podcast, I feel guilty about looking after myself. I don't even know where to start. I don't really know who I am as a mid-40s something. Where can we start in terms of starting to nourish? What can nourishment even look like in terms of nourishing the self?
Tara, I'm curious. Do you have a glass of water with you?
I do, yes.
Right. Let's start with a practice.
I do.
So I love this one because this is, how many times a day do we drink? Potentially hundreds.
Yes.
And for anyone that's like, I haven't got time for this, or I keep forgetting this.
Yes.
So we can pair this practice with drinking water. So what I'd like to do, and for anyone that's listening or watching, if you can join us now, that would be amazing. But if you can't, remember this one for later, because if there's one thing to play with, please let it be this practice. So we are going to have a little experiment with drinking while doing a somatic hold. Now, a somatic hold, from my perspective, it's a physical practice that's designed to shift our nervous system functioning.
Yes.
Moving away from the stress response and into rest and digest. So it's using the body. So the somatic hold I'd like to play with is the hand on heart gesture. And with this hand on heart, it's not just a mechanical, we are imbuing this gesture with a feeling of, I'm deserving of kindness. That's what that hand is saying to us. Okay, now with the hand on heart, let's take a little sip of our water and just notice.
I'm having a second.
Yeah, hopefully it felt really nice and wanting you want more.
And totally different to the sip I had before recording, which was a more functional, less attention, less awareness.
Exactly. So, Tari, you've just named it. What this hand-on-heart gesture does to the experience of drinking is it awakens our senses.
Yes.
It makes us much more present to it. And I think this is the key for us to be able to know self. We've got to be connected with self.
Absolutely.
Okay. So that's only half the practice. The other half of the practice is, once you've grounded yourself hand on heart, I'm deserving of kindness, you've had your mindful sip, you've noticed how it feels to hold the water in your mouth, to swallow it, you've felt the rejuvenation of it, I want you to ask yourself, where am I at? What is going on for me right now? Without judgment, without criticism, where's my body at? What kind of emotional tones are floating about? Where's my head at? We're letting it all be as it is. And then based on that observation, what do I need?
Yes.
That's the second prompt. What do I need? Can you imagine how life would change if we just asked ourselves
Absolutely. At
regular junctures of our day, where am I at? What do I need? How can I lovingly tend? Do I need to sit with the cat on my lap for 30 seconds and just watch the cat breathe?
Yes.
Do I need to see some sunlight? Do I need to get up and out of my chair? Do I need the loo? How often do we override these signals? We're aware of them and we're still like, no, I just need to get that email done. All right. So I'm hoping this practice gets us back on our own radar so we can finally live like we matter as well.
And I will say to people, I do this practice quite a lot, actually. I notice it quite quickly, so I stay with it as well, because what I love there is you're showing people quite often we'll go to quick fix stuff, won't we? So we won't do, and we're actually not kind of, society doesn't really kind of support us. We're not taught at school to check in with ourselves and do body scans, are we?
It's no, we're taught the opposite.
What do I need? Yeah, get on with the thing.
We're distracted from self.
Yes, absolutely. So what I love there is that, how am I going to know what I need if I'm not checking in with self? Because that's where I think sometimes people go towards, and I'm quite bold at this, more prescriptive stuff. That app, I'll do this thing.
Tell me what to do next.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. Yes.
Yeah.
And it's not meant to be in a shaming way, but actually helping people realize how much their self-care can become a chore. And it's not actually related to what they need. So you could really be adding something to your to-do list that's not doing what you need.
Absolutely.
I love the simplicity of it. And that comes back to what I was saying before, that sometimes we overthink this stuff. Just asking yourself those gentle questions, you know, where am I at? Sometimes that can be a big scary thing if you've never done it before. And I love exercises like this, because they're small little ways to just notice. You can build that up, can't you?
I also want to reference that, you know, sometimes that question of what do I need, that can also be really challenging. Yes. If you are so accustomed to meeting the needs of others, to not know where to start, that can feel quite confronting. So that's why there's a whole mind map in How to Be Selfish, which has a whole list of different human needs. And it's like,
I was going to ask you that. So how,
have a little look at that list. Do I need to be witnessed? Do I need comfort? Do I need to move my body? Do I need rest? Do I need forgiveness? You know, that it's sometimes we need it mapped out for us to be able to sort of pinpoint it. But with practice, this becomes much more accessible to us. So let's, like you say, none of this needs to be a performance. It's not something we're getting right or wrong. Let's grow our connection with self and see what blooms from there.
That's actually really compassionate, isn't it? So sometimes when I do ACT therapy kind of in my clinic and I introduce the concept of values, most people just get really overwhelmed about, I have absolutely no idea what they are because I've never been in a culture where I've been asked, but also it can feel scary. So sometimes it is useful to have those little pointers. That kind of comes across to me in terms of your book. It's a nice, compassionate kind of framework that just takes some of that threat mode out of, I don't know what I need. And that can sometimes perpetuate people to just move away. I don't know what I need. It's too much. Or I'll just carry on.
Absolutely. You know. All this whole notion of all you've got to do is just get confident and speak up. Are you kidding? Like there's a whole scaffolding of skills that we need to be able to have these conversations where, you know, like you say, you can't advocate for your needs if you don't know what your needs are. So we've got to start with these little baby steps that bring us back into connection with self, that also allow us the space to question these beliefs that potentially keep us stuck in self erasure. You know, until we question those things, we're forever going to feel this invisible roadblock. So it needs to be very delicately and very carefully. So, and sometimes we need to do it in partnership.
Yes.
You know, sometimes we need someone else to be saying, yes, sweetheart, you have every right to feel as you do. That's exactly how I feel. I think there's, I don't want people to think that, I haven't tried hard enough on my own. Sometimes we need the support of somebody else here.
And that's not failure, you know, that kind of compassionate friend is, you know, sometimes that brain can be so helpful, can't it? It's so unhelpful. And the stuff where I find it can be unhelpful as a kind of a midlife woman balancing it all is that if I am asking for help with someone else, that somehow I've not done something properly, or especially as a mental health professional, well, I don't know my stuff. I can't do this, rather than it being a really nourishing, lovely thing.
Yes. I think you're right there. That's probably where another thing that's differed in terms of the messaging around potentially our parents' generations. Yes. I love the advent of positive psychology. I love the concepts that it's bringing us. Yeah. And I love that we're now shifting our attention from not just looking at what's not working to look at what are the building blocks to a well-lived life.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that research that we've had in the last 20 years has given us amazing roadmap to what a healthy life looks like. But some of these things are now becoming a stick that we beat ourselves with. Like, have I not grown enough in response to this thing? Am I not grateful enough? And I think even our understanding of resilience has become skewed to the point
where I so agree. Yes.
People think that resilience means you just carry on. Well, like, we know the definition of resilience is you bounce back, but if you're bouncing back, that means you have been sent flying first.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that you're impervious. Yes. Right? And there's also this laden sort of mixed up message that resilience means you don't need anybody else.
Yes.
And resilient people are applauded.
That's so true.
Never needing anyone else. It's like, oh my.
But no, sometimes if someone's seeing that on social media, you kind of, and I totally agree. When I qualified 20, you know, odd years ago, resilience had a very different meaning. And sometimes I'll see people in clinic and go, you know, one of their issues, I'm just not resilient. I'm like, let's unpack that, because there's a lot of shame and guilt that can come with that.
Yeah, I think that the definition that I'm coming to of resilience is, it's not an absence of struggle. Please don't think that resilience is an absence of struggle, but I see resilience as an acknowledgement of struggle coupled with action that helps you cope or helps you heal, so that in time you can bounce back when you're ready to, And that action has to be twofold. It's got to be stuff that you extend to yourself. You need to care for self. We need to take responsibility where we can to support ourselves. But we also need to receive love and care.
Absolutely.
This is it. This is resilience, being caring for self and being cared for. Yes. So I really hope that clears up some of those incredibly unhelpful associations with resilience and mental health that it just makes life harder.
And what I love about your recent book is, you know, just I love the fact that you've deconstructed selfish, because that actually kind of comes full circle to the beginning, doesn't it, in terms of helping people to advocate isn't selfish in terms of the derogatory, shaming way. Yeah. What can it do to your possibilities for how you live your life when you're more comfortable with being selfish and putting yourself first?
I want to put my hand up and say I wrote this book because I was woeful at advocating for self.
Yes.
Really, it's not a strength of mine. But the thing that I've noticed the most is I've not only grown as a human being, but the more I allow myself to be honest and transparent in my own choices. But I've noticed that my relationships are blooming.
Wow.
Yeah. When I can be more authentic in how I show up, the possibility for true and meaningful connection is so much greater. And it's a really beautiful thing. And so this roadblock of feeling like we can't burden others or we can't be selfish, think, let's unpick, let's instead of understanding that as human beings there's a binary expression of you're either selfless or you're selfish.
Yes.
I would love for us to think that, you know, you can either be selfish or you can be boundaried, right? Selfless or boundaried. I don't have to be selfless or selfish. I can be boundaried. That's okay. That doesn't make me a selfish so-and-so. It just makes me boundaried. It's all right for there to be limits to our kindness. That's okay.
And sometimes I've noticed, so what you said really resonated there, that in the last year, having a complete reset and sometimes having just your situation mean you have to take a step back and go, I can't, can absolutely there. You just resonated with me in terms of relationships can be better, your sense of self. I can now sit on my sofa and not feel guilty. You know, as in it's just not there. I'm not battling it.
Yeah.
I can leave my emails for a little while and go, it's okay. I can say to my children, I love you, but I can't do that at the moment. Or let's look at this another time. And it's really quite liberating, but also it can lead to a lot more purpose and value in terms of what you want to take on, because you can see things a lot more clearly. You can do more value-based living and working when you've got more capacity.
Absolutely. I think, that word that you've used there, liberating, it is. It's incredibly liberating. Yeah. And it really does is. Freeze you up to live life on purpose.
Yeah. And what I love here is you've got two people who technically, you know, academic backgrounds, as you said, we've got the cognitive knowledge, but we are both actually quite good at being vulnerable. And I think we have on this podcast to say, here are lived examples of it. And I absolutely think that's a key thing, that it's not just about two professionals with our history saying, do all these things and things will change. It's look, here it is, you can live it. And sometimes that can help with people, just that motivation barrier. I think that, you know, if you're listening to something, it's a new concept, you're caught up in doing all the things, to go, there are people who can tell you that it works. And you said before, it's a journey. So you may have to start small. It takes time. It's not a tick box process, is it?
Nope. And even the teensiest tiny step in the right direction is still a movement where you want to go.
Yes.
So even if you were just starting with the hand on heart, and giving yourself a little purposeful pause, that's a great starting point.
Yes. And I guess I will say for people as well that it can soon become quite habitual in terms of you don't have to kind of plan it and do it. And that's how things then develop. And it's not another thing kind of having a to-do list.
No, it literally becomes a way of life.
Yes.
It's a lens through which you see your day unfold. Absolutely. Yeah.
And with that, I've found as well, then those new things are coming and you're noticing, oh, look what happens now. Wow, you have much more present moment awareness, I find, to be able to also notice, gosh, I said no to that thing and, oh, I've got so much more time to think about this now, or it actually feels really good that I've said no to that. You can reflect. So in terms of your book, how do people, I want to know, so many amazing things about you, but we've only got so much time on the podcast. I'll have to be back on again. If people want to find out more about you and your work, how can they find you and your books? Where do you hang out?
I spend a lot of time on Instagram.
Which I recommend. Go find you.
I share a little love note on Instagram every single day. Lots of people do journaling. I share posts on Instagram. Yes. For me, it's like these are my promises to self, and I share them in the hope that they might inspire somebody else. So that's where you can get a flavor of my work and my approach. And my books are widely available. There's a link in my bio for anyone that's interested in my books. And go and ask your local bookshop. If they haven't stocked them, they will order them in for you. We can support local that way. That's a great way of getting a flavour for my approach.
I will also throw in there, you have a wonderful self-care book for winter, which I thoroughly recommend because I devoured that. There are so many books you've written, but they're just a couple that really have that extra level of resonation for me. In terms of kind of next steps for you, anything interesting that people need to know you're up to or we can signpost them to?
I'm just on this mission to encourage people to understand that it's okay to prioritize self. So that's really where I'm at right now. And having more conversations, shifting the focus away from self-care to self-advocacy. I'm really enjoying these conversations. So that's where I'm at the moment. I'm hoping there will be more opportunities to write.
Yes.
I'm going to say it out loud because who knows who's listening.
You've heard it now.
And I do. Absolutely. I've got a couple of ideas already percolating, but watch this space.
I definitely will. I always ask my guests for one little adversity takeaway. If there was one little nugget of anything that you can leave us, whether it's a mantra, a bit of advice or something to reflect on, what might that be?
Oh, okay. So we've already talked about how fundamental self-compassion is to our ability to cope with life, what's happening outside of us and what's happening within us. For anyone that finds it difficult to be tender with self, can we finish with one more somatic hold that sort of cultivates tenderness without us having to try so hard? It's not another cognitive strategy. Oh, why could I not find the words? It is the face hug. So if we can rub hands together to create a little bit of warmth, and then can we tenderly cradle our chin in our hands, and can we notice how nice it feels to be held? And hopefully with this gentle gesture of care towards self, we feel a little more loving towards self, and hopefully our words.
Yes, it feels amazing. It's so simple, isn't it? And portable.
Yes. Wherever we are, we can always administer a little emotional first aid with the face hug. And I hope that's something. Can there be a daily prescription of the face hug?
Yes, I love that. Start a movement. Susie, thank you so much. It's been, I know, because your schedule is just so busy, I know. So making time for this means the world. And it's lovely to get to hear all your wise words and connect.
Well, thank you so much, Tara, because what's happened here is a beautiful exchange. So thank you for filling my cup. I really, really appreciate you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Adversity Psychologist podcast. I'm Dr. Tara Quintarillo, and it's been lovely having you along to listen to this episode. If you want to find more about me, you can find me at drtara.co.uk. So you'll see everything I'm up to, my media work, my collaborations, my clinical work, if you're interested in that. And of course, all the other episodes of the Adversity Psychologist podcast. If you're interested in coming on, you can also contact me and let me know what you would like to come and talk about. I'd love to hear from you.